Okay, meeting will come to order. This is the Governmental Operations and Veterans Affairs Committee today on March 8th. And apologize for the little bit late start here. As you know, last night was precinct caucuses, so we have some members that were leaving their community at 5 or 6 this morning for 4 or 5 6-hour drive. So I know that some of the members will be coming in late, but we don't quite have a quorum yet, but I would like to get started pretty quickly here with the overview. I have just a couple of quick announcements before we get to that point. Members, there's a flyer by your information there in your packet about a legislative effectiveness gathering next Monday on March 13th, and that is a follow-up from the conference we had in February. So I hope that you can put that on your calendar. And as you know, we're having several bills in our committee here that relate to legislative effectiveness, so I hope we can get good attendance from our committee members here. And then next announcement, we have a new committee legislative assistant with us today. Today is Alicia Davis's last day here in the committee. She's taken a new job as a youth pastor at a church, so she'll be starting there tomorrow with teenagers, so she said it'll be a much easier job. But I would like to introduce our new committee legislative assistant, and she's actually in the audience learning some of the things until she sits up here in the chair tomorrow. But I'd like to have Sarah Durenberger stand up, and if you'd like to just take a minute to introduce yourself, Sarah. Why don't you go up to the mic? Because we're going to want the answer about if you're related to the former Minnesota.
Yeah. As Representative Tingle said, I am Sarah Durenberger. I'll be starting tomorrow filling in for Alicia. I was actually born and raised on a hog farm in Illinois, and I moved to Minnesota last September after getting married. And that's how I received my new last name, which brings on all the questions. I am related to the senator distantly and through marriage. He's my father-in-law's second cousin.
Twice removed.
And we live over in Plymouth, and my husband is actually a police officer in the city of Plymouth. So
great. Oh, welcome. Thank you. Okay, I think we have a quorum now, so let's get on with the business. First, with the approval of minutes, Representative Neil Peterson.
Madam Chair, I'll move the approval.
Representative Peterson moves approval of the minutes of the March 2nd meeting. Any discussion? All in favor of that, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and amendments or the minutes are approved. Okay. Today we have three bills up, and I know we need to complete our meeting by 11:45 with session. So we're going to start with an overview by the Minnesota State Lottery. So with us today is Clint Harris, who's the executive director, and I believe one of his staff members. So gentlemen, welcome to the committee, and if you could introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Clint Harris, Executive Director of the Minnesota State Lottery. I have Todd Mackey, one of my researchers here, to help me. And I've got Dale McDonald, the lottery's attorney, here. So with that, I'll just jump right in. It sounds like time is short here. In April, the Minnesota State Lottery will celebrate 16 years of raising money for the state of Minnesota. $5.5 billion in lottery tickets have been sold so far. $1.3 billion has been returned to the state, and $3.2 billion has been awarded in prizes. Minnesota retailers have earned over $325 million in the 16 years. Today, I'd like to touch on some of the major points of lottery operations. First, what we don't do. We don't sell or regulate pull tabs or other charitable gaming. We do sell scratch-off and online lottery tickets. This is not an easy job. We sell in a highly competitive and rapidly changing marketplace. We describe ourselves as a business in a government wrapper. Competition is more than just other gaming. It's every other impulse item sold at the store and other forms of entertainment and recreation as well. We have to compete for shelf space and visibility. No retailer is required to sell lottery tickets, and no customer has to buy a lottery ticket. Our surveys show that in terms of participation, the lottery is the game of choice in Minnesota. Nearly 50% more Minnesota adults bought a lottery ticket last year than went to a casino, and more than twice as many bought a lottery ticket than a pull tab. But in terms of dollars wagered, we are far from the largest. We don't know how much is wagered at casinos, but one outside estimate placed their after-prize revenue at around $1.5 billion, suggesting wagering in excess of $10 billion a year. The illegal gambling number is an estimate from the Department of Public Safety. We offer two basic types of games, scratch and online. Last fiscal year, we introduced 45 new scratch games. Each retailer has between 6 and 20 of these games on sale at any one time. Different players have different preferences for game themes, play styles, top prizes, and even price. And they especially like new games. Online games don't change as often. Tickets are generated by a computer terminal at the retailer that is connected to a central system. Powerball is the best known online game, but not the only one. Both types of games have security that is extensive and impressive, as documented by the Office of the Legislative Auditor. Fiscal year 05 was our best sales year ever, and halfway through fiscal year 06, we are on a pace to beat last year's sales record. Sales are difficult to project and depend on things like gas prices, the state of the economy, and the random nature of jackpots. But we are pretty confident that sales this year will be at least $450 million, and maybe as high as $435 million. Fiscal year 05 was also a record year for the money the lottery provided the state. We are aiming to beat that record in fiscal year 06. So far, it looks good. At the end of January, we projected a profit of $110 million for the year, and with the big Powerball jackpot in February, we expect to beat that by a million or two. Here's how the lottery dollar is divided. The single biggest item is prizes. Without adequate prizes, no one would play. Finding the level that maximizes revenues to the state is always a challenge. Last year, we held operating costs down to 5.5% of revenue. Retailers earn about 6 cents for every dollar worth of tickets they sell. The lottery contributes to state programs in several ways. Net proceeds are what a business would call profits. The Constitution guarantees that 40% of the proceeds go to the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund through the year 2024. The rest now goes to the general fund, though that is at the discretion of the legislature. Players have a year to claim prizes. Any prize not claimed after that time goes to the general fund. In fiscal year 05, that amounted to $7.8 million. There is a 6.5% in lieu of sales tax on lottery tickets. Disposition of this is up to the legislature. It is currently split between the Department of Natural Resources Game and Fish Fund, the General Fund, and the Natural Resources Fund, which goes for state, metro, and local parks and trails in the state's three zoos. And here are more ways the lottery contributes to state programs. Each biennium, the legislature makes an appropriation from the lottery prize fund to finance the Department of Human Services compulsive gambling program. This appropriation was $3.6 million for the current biennium. It is one of the best funded programs in the country, and the lottery is the sole source of funding for this program. Every prize winner over $600 is checked for debts owed the state, including back taxes and child support. The lottery has collected over $2 million this way over the last 15 years. Prizes are subject to the federal and state income taxes. In fiscal year 05, more than $7 million was withheld for Minnesota state income taxes alone. The lottery was authorized by voters in 1988, and the sale of tickets began in the spring of 1990. With the change in the 2003 session, the director is appointed by the governor with the advice and consent of the Senate, and now serves at the pleasure of the governor. There is not a line item appropriation for our agency. Instead, we have a spending cap recommended by the governor and approved by the legislature. A task force to study the best style of governance was established during the 2004 session. It was made up of gubernatorial appointees and members of the legislature. The recommendation is currently before the Ways and Means Committee in the House. On the Senate side, it is in the State and Local Government Operations Committee. Since fiscal year 03, as you see, cuts in operating expenses have come from staff costs, advertising, promotion, and office space reductions. We're predicting that our actual operating expenses, excluding the cost of goods, will be $24.6 million this year, fiscal year 06, which is $2 million under our spending cap. We will continue to invest when it does lead to increased revenues. In closing, I'd like to share our mission statement and the values we abide by. The lottery offers fun, innovative, and secure games that create excitement, reflect Minnesota values, and maximize contributions to the state. Integrity, we will meet the highest ethical and professional standards. As to service, we will meet and exceed the needs of our customers. We will not be limited by the way we've always done it. And we will create a work culture that instills creativity and fun. So, with that, there's a wealth of information on our webpage, which is identified on there. You'll also be receiving our 2006 overview that contains district-specific information about the lottery. Please feel free to contact me or any of my staff. And, of course, we welcome you to collectively or individually tour our offices in Roseville. With that, I'll open it to any questions of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. I appreciate that. And I know one of the things you noted was record year in 2005, and you expect 2006 to even do better. And I just really want to congratulate you on bringing the efficiencies and effectiveness there to the Minnesota Lottery. I know at one point we were looking at if that money that's brought in is spent efficiently, and I know you're returning a lot of it to the state, so we really appreciate that, as a lot of it goes to natural resource projects and general fund and other things. So, and then, members, I just wanted to make note, too, last week we heard the LCMR reform legislation, and, of course, where the LCMR gets the funding is through the Minnesota Lottery proceeds. So I just wanted to make that tie-in if anybody was not aware of the connection between LCMR and Minnesota Lottery. They're certainly two separate groups, but that's where the funding comes from. So questions from members? Did such a great job. You just... I know this was a good overview. I'm curious about the slides. It might be nice maybe to get copies of that material. It had a lot of good information.
Yes, we'll get that to you and your staff.
Great, appreciate that. Okay, well, Mr. Mackey, you want to say a few words just to make it official that you were here and participated in the meeting?
Yep, here I am. Okay. My name is Todd Mackey, and I'm a laptop guy.
All right. Mr. McDonald, did you want to say anything? Great. Okay. Well, thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate your hard work. Thanks for the overview today. Okay. We're looking for Representative Broad's got the next bill up. I know Representative Erdahl is here. Let's give her... Representative Broad is on her way. Members, if you want to just take a minute to look through the materials in your packet, Representative Broad's bill was one that we heard last year and went to the General Register on the House floor. And as the procedure is, anything that is on the General Register at the end of the first year of the biennium comes back to the last committee that it was heard in. So I think it's more of a procedural thing as we passed this bill last year. So if you take a look at it and it sounds familiar, it's because we did hear this one in this committee last year. And then Representative De La Forest's bill that will follow that comes from the Subcommittee on Employee Relations, the Legislative Coordinating Commission. So there's several materials in your packet that relate to that, as well as amendment to get the bill in the shape that he'd like. And then finally, Representative Erdahl's bill will have a delete all amendment and then another minor amendment to it. So if you want to just take a minute and look through that information, because we will adjourn today at 11:45 because of session. And I know not everybody was here at the beginning of the meeting. There is an information piece there with your materials about a dinner on March 13th with legislators, and that's a follow-up to the conference we had in February at the Humphrey Institute related to legislative effectiveness. In fact, I thought I saw Representative Loeffler. I lost her. Okay. And just on that note, members, we will have two committee days yet in March where we'll talk specifically about legislative reform issues. So if you have some bills you're introducing on that topic, please get them with bill numbers right away, because we'd like to get those ideas heard and move those things through the process here. I think we're just a little over 3 weeks out from the first deadline, so things will be moving here pretty quickly. We have one evening meeting each week over the next 3 weeks, and potentially a couple of Friday meetings as well. And that calendar should be in your packet. So as far as we know, we'll still use those dates. If for some reason we don't have enough bills or things go a little faster, you know, we may cancel those times that were scheduled, but I'd rather do that than add extra ones on. Representative Loeffler, we were just talking about the Monday night dinner meeting about legislative effectiveness, and we're waiting for our next author here. I don't know, did you want to just take a minute and talk about some of the work of the group that was connected with the conference at the Humphrey Institute? Do you want to pull your mic down? Representative Loeffler.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. Sorry, I was out for a minute. The joint seminar that we had with the Senate, with the Humphrey Institute National Conference of State Legislators, had over 60 legislators from the House and the Senate participating, who worked into work groups after hearing from national experts, hearing the results of our House survey that was presented to the committee here early in the session, right at the beginning of the session or just before, and then went into work groups to brainstorm what we thought might be effective changes. I have to say that the boards around the room, I think, were covered with probably over 100 or 200 different ideas, and those were grouped. And the end result was we broke into about 7 or 8 work groups who actually came, then some of those merged, and we actually came out with some very specific work plans. And Senator Sheila Cascaden has just sent out to members a summary of that, and all who participated and those who weren't able to are invited to a dinner on the 13th of this month to talk further about how do we go forward. The emphasis was not so much on gigantic, huge changes, as much as what are practical things that the 60-some legislators who participated could do now. And so we had committee chairpersons who volunteered to do what we've been doing now this year in this committee, which is let people mix up where they're seated. Apparently in the Senate, it's even more rigid. They sit people by seniority, with the most senior people sitting next to the chair, and they sit in partisan blocks, you know, staring at each other across the table. And the thought was that's part of why people don't get to know each other and develop, you know, colleague-type relationships in terms of the few opportunities that we do have to interact with each other. There's a variety of small actions like that that we felt like as a whole we could take, as well as the larger ones that will be coming before this committee in terms of changing the budget process, the budget timelines, some of the ways that we structure our work. Some of the ideas will have to wait till the next start of the next session, because they're really about how do we organize our committee structure and how does our committee structure parallel that in the Senate, so that when we come together as a conference committee on a key issue, we actually have a common set of understandings of that issue. And so some of it is short term, some of it is simple and has already been implemented, some of it will wait till next year when we reorganize, and some of it will come before this committee as specific pieces of legislation dealing with the budget process, one of which we've already enacted, which is the continuing appropriations bill.
Great, thank you very much. I see our next author is here, Representative Broad. Welcome to the committee, and Chair will move that House file 433 be recommended to pass and go to the general register. Representative Broad.
Well, Madam Chair, if the committee could hold for a moment. I grabbed the wrong file. I apologize. essentially, depending on the questions that are asked, maybe we could proceed, and if I need the file, I'll run and grab it. I'm so sorry.
Sure, no problem. And Representative Broad, you know, since we did hear this bill in committee last year, you know, you might be fine just without it, so please proceed.
Okay. Well, I don't have the bill in front of me, thank you, but I have another purple file upstairs that has every piece of information that we could possibly want. But essentially what this bill does is that it states, doesn't exactly state, but it'll essentially provide that if the Senate does not act on the confirmation of commissioners, those commissioners are therefore deemed confirmed. Essentially, the Senate has the opportunity under the Constitution for advice and consent, and in my view, they have been not doing that advice and consent in a timely manner. Essentially, their advice and consent should be around the fact that, you know, are these candidates qualified? Do they have the knowledge that they need to do the job, the good job for the state of Minnesota? Instead, what we're finding is they hold their consent to the end of a year. We're finding that they're instead doing a job performance review, and that's really not what advice and consent is truly about. So with that, Madam Chair, this is an opportunity to change the process in a way that works towards moving things along as opposed to blocking things. And, Madam Chair, your committee has done and will do a great job on a number of reforms. This is just one other reform that I think would be helpful in moving the system along for the state of Minnesota.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Broad? Representative Lawther.
Madam Chair and Representative Broad, I'm just trying to think of different circumstances that might arise. And I'm thinking of if we have, sometimes we've had commissioners, whether it's under a governor that's Democratic or Republican or independent, that people have not been totally confident of, that they were ready for that position or that they'd, at least their initial leadership had caused some concern. And sometimes I suspected action on an appointment is actually delayed to give that person a chance to get their feet under them and, you know, establish a clearer track record rather than risk what potentially could be a negative reaction to it and an uncomfortable hearing, at least, when they really just need a little bit of time to get used to, you know, the situation that they're in. Many people come from outside a governmental service. They're not used to running large, complex organizations. They're not used to the kind of fast-paced process they're thrown into with the legislative session. And so I'm thinking that the actual process that we have right now with the ability to delay it to the next year actually may avoid some of the partisan acrimony and sort of embarrassing hearings that some people who stepped up to public service might be put into. Have you thought about that situation?
Representative Broad.
Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, thank you for your comments. I do think that it's important to have to not have political plays happening, and I think we're seeing that more often than the situation that you're talking about. The people who are being brought forward obviously need to be quality individuals. They need to be competent. But if the purpose of advice and consent is a job review, I would be surprised. I think the purpose of advice and consent is to make sure that there's quality candidates who are eligible and qualified for the job, not to determine how well they're doing on the job. That I think is done by the appointing by the appointing body in terms of you know, removing them from the job. But there is plenty of time to understand. There's 1 year, essentially, for them to get their feet wet and to truly understand whether they are going to be a good individual. This doesn't require action within X number of days. It requires action in the first part of the biennium.
Okay, we have several members with questions. Next up, Representative Sheldon Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was curious, Representative Rod, does this bill have any been introduced on the Senate side, or is it moving anywhere?
Representative Rod.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Johnson. Last year, the bill was introduced on the Senate side by former Senator Kleist. It has not been reintroduced under another author.
Okay, next up is Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to get back to the line of questioning that Representative Loeffler started with. But I think that Representative Broad may have touched on this. Let me just recap. It appears that if a governor makes an appointment, I'm thinking primarily after a new election, a new administration comes in. To be clear, then, the Senate has the entire session, about 5 months, to work with to do those confirmations, or else they become automatic. Okay. The assumption is they are confirmed. If there is a vacancy during the governor's cycle, they have the next session to confirm or deny. And if it's the end of the session, within 20 days, they, in effect, have the whole summer and fall to just kind of observe performance, competence, and so on, because then they have the first 3 weeks of the next session to address. Is that what we're understanding here?
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Beard. We did put in an amendment. I think it's in the bill regarding that last piece, and I think Representative Kahn had a concern. What if a governor comes in and puts an appointment on the table within the last few days of session? Do you have to act? No. You do have that time over the interim, and it also would apply to interim appointments as well. So I think that this is a fair approach. I think it's a reasonable approach. It's a movement to essentially get action on these commissioners as opposed to using them as political pawns.
Follow-up, Representative Beard?
Just an observation. I am a believer in the Senate confirmation process, and I know that gets me in a little, it raises blood pressures with people on my side of the aisle, but, you know, from a state policy perspective, having advice and Senate of the advice and consent of the Senate for people running agencies or in most cases commissions, I think is just good policy. Just to remind this committee, I did have a small bill here last year that dealt with the Metropolitan Airports Commission. None of those commissioners or the chair have to face any scrutiny from the legislature, which I have some concerns with. This bill does not address any of those concerns because there are several other commissions also that don't rise to agency level that don't have any advice and consent from the Senate. Just so you know that that's out there, and some of us are paying attention to that. But this apparently is just agency heads. That, I think, is where the constitutional question is, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay. Is that to that point?
Yeah.
Representative
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, why haven't you prepared that as an amendment to this bill? You've been here a whole 2 years without learning that.
There is a separate bill, actually, Madam Chair, that deals with that is struggling to make its way through the process.
Well, this goes a little further along.
Okay. Next up is Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Pull your mic on.
Last year we passed this bill, and I think we had two people that maybe voted no in regard to it, so you received good support from this organization, this committee at least. Just as a case in point, will you remind me again as to whether or not this will solve the problem? Does this piece of legislation solve the problem that exists at the present time? Or does it do it partly and then we come back again and so on? And the reason why I say that is we hear the bill 1 year and nothing happens. Now we're doing the same thing. I'm just wondering if this is a solution to the problem. And I do have some reservations in regard to the Senate. To be quite frank, they're supposed to be the approvers on some occasions and so on. So could you help me with that, please?
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Dempsey. I don't think there is a silver bullet to solve the problem. I think we all might define the problem a little bit differently. I do think that this, though, will solve a problem, and it essentially will just move the process along. I think sometimes we enable the process to be halted in a variety of different ways. And inaction on advice and consent halts the process. It essentially holds the commissioners as political pawns and doesn't allow them to get into their job and do the work for the state of Minnesota without the Senate looking over their shoulder at every turn. So I think this does solve a problem in the regard of getting the process to move along. We need to get some of these things moving, whether vote it up, vote it down, but let's vote. It's the same thing with these commissioners. Vote them up, vote them down, but move the process along so they're not being held hostage.
Okay. Any other questions from members? Okay, with that, Chair renews the motion that House File 433, First Engrossment, be recommended to pass and go to the General Register. Any discussion? All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and bill goes to General Register.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Broad. Okay, members, next up is Representative De La Forest. And there are several pieces of material in your packet related to this bill. This comes to us from the Subcommittee on Employee Relations of the Legislative Coordinating Commission. Representative Bill Forrest is the chair of that commission. And chair will move that House File 3114 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee of State Government Finance. Representative DeForest, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and colleagues. This must be a committee almost as large as Ways and Means here. A lot of people here. Thank you for moving my bill, Madam Chair. I do have an author's amendment that will put the bill in the form in which I would like to present it. So if either you'd move it or if there's no objection, I would appreciate that.
Sure. Chair will move that the amendment coded H3114A1 be recommended as an amendment on this bill here, and this will put it in the shape that the author desires. Any discussion on the A1 amendment? All in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. The bill is in the shape that you would like. Representative DeForest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and members, what you have before you here this morning is a rather regular occurrence, and what that is it's the Omnibus Contract Ratification Bill, and what it entails is the various collective bargaining agreements, pay plans, and other employee relations-related legislation that comes before us. Many of you are veterans here. Some of you are newer. What happens is the Department of Employee Relations, either in consultation and negotiation with the state unions or of its own action, takes measures to improve pay plans or to go through the collective bargaining process. Once those contracts are ratified or approved by the Department of Employee Relations, they come to the Subcommittee on Employee Relations for what we call interim ratification. The Subcommittee on Employee Relations has 10 members, 5 senators, 5 House members. It's split down the middle. We have 3 DFL senators, 2 Republican senators, 3 Republican House members, and 2 DFL House members. And the bill you have before you today is a committee bill. It isn't my bill. I think it's a good bill, but it is presented today by Representatives Quinzing, Bruce Anderson, Tom Rukavina, and Deb Hillstrom as well. And the question that inevitably comes up with a bill like this is sort of, hey, is there anything controversial in here? And while it's in the eye of the beholder, and I would not presume to tell my colleagues how to vote, I will tell you that every item in this bill today was unanimously passed by the 10 of us. It is a very bipartisan type of subcommittee. We all work together. The final product may be not what each one of us individually would have done, but it's what the 10 of us thought was in the best interest of the taxpayers and everybody else. And I've got Greg Hubinger with me here today, who can go over some of the highlights of the bill for your consideration. If you have any questions, we would certainly be happy to answer them. And so, Madam Chair, if you will, I'll turn the microphone over to Mr. Hubinger.
Mr. Hubinger, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission and the Subcommittee on Employee Relations. This bill will ratify 9 labor contracts and 5 compensation plans. There were 2 primary focuses of discussion in the negotiations for these biennial contracts. The first is with the State Employee Group Insurance Program, which provides health and dental insurance to employees in the executive branch, to the judiciary, and to members and staff of the legislature. The good news in the state insurance program is that, as you know, there were no increases in premiums for calendar year 06, and the estimate is that premiums will increase about 10% for calendar year 07. Other than that, there weren't any substantive changes in the insurance program. The other focus was on wages and salaries. There was some variation amongst the labor unions, but most employees will be receiving a 2% across-the-board increase in each year of the contract. In addition, most employees will be receiving step increases or performance-based increases that are given on their anniversary dates. Those performance-based increases vary depending on the contract between 2.5% and about 4%. I believe there's a packet for a summary in your folders. The last page of that handout is a settlement tracking sheet that the subcommittee uses to keep track of the cost of these contracts. That sheet shows the across-the-board increases and the impacts that these contracts will have on costs for this biennium and an estimate for the impacts on the next biennium. Madam Chair, that's a very quick overview.
Okay. Questions from members? Okay, let's see if there's anybody from the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill. Okay, seeing none, any members? This is so thorough that we totally dazzled you. Okay, Representative DeLaForce, get the last word before we vote here. Representative DeLaForce.
Madam Chair and colleagues, thank you for your time this morning.
Okay, short and sweet, we like that. Okay, with that, Chair renews the motion that House File 3114, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. Any discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and bill goes to State Government Finance.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. Okay. Next up is Representative Erdahl. He's been very patient in the audience, and I know that he has some people that would like to testify related to his bill. And members, there are two amendments in your packet. So, members, I'll bring up the bill here in a moment. I just wanted to point out there's going to be a delete all amendment, and the part that relates to our committee is Section 3 on rulemaking and Section 4 related to the task force. So with that, Chair will move that House File 2492 be recommended pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Education Policy. And then Representative Erdahl would like to get his amendment on that will put the bill in the shape that he would like. So Chair will move the DE2 amendment, that's H2492DE2, as an amendment to put the bill in the shape he'd like. Any discussion of the DE2 amendment? All in favor of DE2? Signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and DE2 is adopted. And Representative Erdahl, that puts the bill in the shape that you'd like. Welcome to the committee. Representative Erdahl, please present your bill as amended.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chairman, committee members. Pleasure to be here this morning. School safety and hazards facing our students should be of paramount concern to us all. The urgency to address the concern is made even more compelling by this fact. 24,764 acts of violence were reported to the Minnesota Department of Education during the 2004-2005 school year. These acts included assault, fighting, harassment, terror, threats, and weapons. There were 1,259 weapon violations, 41 of them involving guns, and 80 bomb threats. Now, while we may want to believe that the schools in our own areas are unscathed, the statistics show that violence is felt statewide. In all, 342 school districts and charter schools contributed to the total for the 2004-2005 school year. Now, these acts run the gamut from the deaths at Red Lake to threats with guns to injuries from sharp pencils to harassment. Some infractions are inherently more serious than others, but which others may ultimately lead to the unthinkable. In light of this, we must become more prepared in how we deal with violence in our schools. I propose to address this in this legislation by requiring that schools include 5 lockdown drills per school year in their crisis management plan instead of the current policy of just 1. We'll ask that students be included in the drills and that the drills be held at varying times of the school day. To accommodate that increase, the number of yearly fire drills will be lowered from 9 to 5, and there will be 1 tornado drill. This will keep the total number of yearly emergency drills the same. I have spoken to the state fire marshal on this topic, and he has indicated that they will take a neutral position on the reduction of fire drills. There were 72 fires in our schools last year with no deaths resulting. I've been told that 1 in 4 of our school administrators have trainings in school security. Originally, we had planned to spell out how this training should occur in Minnesota. However, we discovered that more questions than answers were emanating from our discussion. Therefore, this bill will create a task force to address these issues. Who should receive the training? How should the training occur? What should be taught? Which competencies should be included in school administrator and teacher curriculum? What federal supplemental funds could we expect? And this task force will be working with the Department of Education. This legislation will also authorize the Board of School Administrators to create competencies in school hazards and security as part of the licensing and training of prospective school administrators.
And essentially, that's the reasons for the bill and the main components of it. With me, Dan Murphy.
What is your rank, by the way?
I am City of Bloomington's Homeland Security Coordinator.
And actually, the original impetus of this bill came from an email by Officer Murphy, and he has a brief presentation as well.
Officer Murphy, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. My name is Dan Murphy. I am the City of Bloomington's Homeland Security Coordinator. I am also a hazardous device technician on the city's bomb squad. I also serve as the incoming Regional 3 Director of the International Association of Bomb Technicians and Investigators, which in my world is a group of over 4,000 people internationally that are bomb technicians and respond to this. I'm glad I'm sitting here. I didn't fit in the chair up there. I hope it's my gun belt, that not my girth, that did it. But anyway, so who would have thought I'd be more comfortable sitting here? I'm going to go through a very brief PowerPoint presentation, but my start in this came unusual. It's like a Grateful Dead song. What a long, strange trip it's been. I responded to a call at one of our schools, an elementary school, and they had a person out on the playground who was giving polished stones and coins to the children. We thought this was very unusual. We responded that this call was a priority to us. Upon my arrival, I didn't like how the school handled it. They had poor communications. Things didn't work out very well. I found this person a half a block from the school. He had three rifles in his van, and he had bags full of ammunition. In his world, the sky was yellow and the sun was blue, and he told me that he had been sent to Earth by Osama bin Laden to fight for Jesus. This disturbed me greatly, obviously, and we sent him to get him some help. However, what it really illustrated to me was a lack of pre-planning in our schools for an event like that. I went to the school, never having been involved in lockdowns before, and we developed a plan that all of a sudden took wing. Currently, the City of Bloomington has endorsed a concept that our schools do 9 lockdown drills a year. That is done. It's been embraced by Superintendent Gary Press. We are doing 9 lockdown drills a year in each of our schools, with the exception of 3, and we're working on those 3. But who responds to the crisis when it happened within a school? Our school staff, our district office, our juvenile office, and police department. Everybody responds to a crisis within the school. So it's really in everybody's best interest to take a proactive stance to the training and the safety inside of our schools. As you're well aware, State Statute 299F requires that the schools do 9 fire drills for each school, 1 for each month that they're in session. My question is, why do we do 9? Why 5? Well, it's when under stress we perform how we've trained. And if we haven't trained, we're going to perform unpredictably. In that moment of crisis, we will revert to how we have been trained. If we have no training to fall back on, we're going to perform unpredictably. But fire deaths in schools, Representative Erdahl touched on it, since 1992, in nursery schools, K-12, public and private daycare, and colleges, in trade school, we have had 0 fire deaths. And if you ask any teacher with tenure, can you do a fire drill with your eyes closed? And the answer is yes, because they've been practicing it this many times over and over. So, of course, this law is working. The police department, unfortunately, we haven't been as proactive with school safety, and this bill addresses that. Since 1992 to 2004, you can see the number of people killed in school-related violence, and this is at alternative schools, high schools, junior high schools, and elementary school. The elementary school was the one that surprised me the most. The last death within an elementary school was in New Jersey last winter, where a 7-year-old was stabbed to death by her non-custodial father. The videotape that you're seeing is from inside the cafeteria in Columbine, Littleton, Colorado. They did not have the benefit of hindsight that we have in the issues that happened at Columbine. They did not have a lockdown plan. No one had gone to their school to do a safety assessment, and they did not know how to respond to this. Their training, their teachers were begging their students to get underneath the tables where they thought that they would have relative safety, and there they were killed. You can see Klebold and Harris. You can see students running off to the side. You can see an incendiary device that has detonated and is now starting to burn. And we had the number of dead that we had there. And, of course, you guys are well aware of Ricori, of Red Lake. It can happen anywhere. And this bill certainly addresses that. And I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Officer Murphy. Okay. Questions? Representative Erdahl.
Also have Pat Defke, who's a behavioral specialist and administrative designer.
Hi, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. My name is Pat Defke. I'm employed by Bloomington School District, Indian Mounds Elementary. I'm a special education paraprofessional. I work in behavior management, and I am the administrative designee. Thank you for allowing me to present today. We would all like to believe that our schools are safe and that lockdown measures are not necessary. However, as Dan stated, our world is no longer a safe place, as evidenced by the events of 9/11, Columbine, Ricori, and right here in Minnesota at Red Lake. We cannot continue to believe that this type of tragedy only happens somewhere else. This was made alarmingly clear to us at Indian Mounds with an incident that occurred in our school a little over a year ago. We now recognize the need to be proactive instead of reactive, and we feel that Indian Mounds at this point in time is much better prepared to handle any emergency that may occur in our building. With that incident that Dan referred to in September of 2004, a mentally unstable man with, as it turned out, a weapon-filled van approached students on our playground. Our staff did call 911. Officer Murphy was one of the officers that responded to our call. The situation was handled by the police, and we later found out just how tragic the situation could have been. Dan appeared at our building the next day. Our principal was out of the building, so he approached me and said, I want to tell you, you did a lot of things right, but you did a lot of things wrong. And that was the beginning of a partnership with Dan Murphy and our building. And we began to form a plan to make our building more secure. Our plan now consists of having all doors locked except the main entrance. We have a sign-in system that is very specific. We have numbered badges with lanyards. Each badge is numbered. Anybody coming into our building must sign in. They have a numbered badge. They place their name next to the number. We know exactly who is in our building, the purpose for them being there, and they wear this tag during the entire time that they're in our building. They sign out and return the badge when they exit. The total cost for the lanyards and the badges is $185 for 50 of them, and these were made for us by our district print shop. Officer Murphy came to our building. He toured our building, went through every corridor, every room, every storage area, every classroom, and helped us to understand the best way to make that particular area secure. We went with his recommendations as far as needing to move people, students to different areas, and made sure we put into place the fact that all of our classrooms, all of the rooms in our building are locked at all times. They're kept in a locked mode. We have a plan for children at recess and a way of entry into the building that we've created. We have placed blinds and curtains on all windows that look into the hallway. Total cost, $100. We also have our lockdown directions for each area posted by the door. With that, we have a system where we have this little green card that's attached. In the event of a lockdown, that's our notice to the police. We fly that under the door. When we go to a lockdown, with our lockdown drills, they're very simple. They're much less disruptive than a fire drill. We simply sound a signal. We announce over the PA system, this is a lockdown, this is a lockdown. It's followed by a specific series of rings that is known only to our staff. Staff immediately peeks out into the hallway, pulls anybody who is in the hallway into the classrooms or other areas, pulls the doors locked, and remember the doors are in locked modes, they are locked automatically, close blinds, and then slip that green card under the door, which is informing police when they arrive at our building that there are people in the building or in those particular areas. Class continues as usual, no disruption. It takes seconds for that to be put into place. Our teachers go about their business of conducting classes, and they wait for an announcement of all clear. We have a specific all clear that goes over our PA system with certain code words that our staff is familiar with, allowing them to know that this isn't all clear, that it isn't somebody who is going to announce an all clear. So we have covered all bases. During our drill, we have specified staff members that walk through the building. We check the handles to make sure they're locked. We look for those green cards, and we are satisfied that we've done a good job with our lockdown. In the event of a real lockdown, the steps are very similar, except the lights would be turned off in the classroom. We would gather students into a protected, the most protected area of the room, and the students would be asked to remain quiet. We turn off the Do Not Disturb feature on our phones and turn on walkie-talkies for those of us who have them. And we do not open our doors unless we are informed by a police officer that the police have arrived and are asking us to open the door. They have a special card known only to our staff that they would slide under the door so that we can be sure that this is actually a police officer asking us to open the door. And then we wait for the all clear. The overall response from our parents and our staff has been very positive. We spent time creating this plan, which is very comprehensive. We have copies of the plan if anyone would like it. We also have it online. This plan, now that it's been created, would be very simple for any school to pick up and to implement. The work has already been done. Our committee still meets. We assess how we do with our lockdowns, and we continue to address any items that would come up. We have a plan for recess. We have a plan for school buses arriving or departing. We feel that we've got everything covered. We had an event that happened at our school where we were, in fact, we had several, but the one that comes to mind when we actually had a real lockdown situation, several of our teachers on one side of our building reported hearing gunshots, and we live in a very quiet, very residential place, so the sound of gunshots was very alarming. The call was made to 911. We went down into a lockdown mode. This happened within seconds. We felt confident that our students and staff were safe. Classes continued. The police arrived, did a check, and found out that there was a military ceremony going on at a senior residence in our neighborhood. But we were proud of the fact that we responded appropriately and quickly, and that had it been a real issue, we would have all been safe. Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Thank you, Ms. Depke. And as you mentioned, and I'm glad to see that this bill is being heard in the Committee on Governmental Operations and Veterans Affairs. Vice Chair Severson.
To that point, Madam Chair. Ms. Depke, in the situation where it's during lunchtime and you've got all some students in class, some of them in a commons area, kind of like what had happened here, what's the instructions for the students on where to flee to in the event that the shooting starts in the commons area?
Ms. Depke.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Cindy. We, on our lunchroom doors, they are all set to close automatically. So we would secure those children the minute the lockdown goes into effect, those doors would be closed. We also, if the situation were to happen, for instance, in our lunchroom, if that is where the danger would happen to be, we have exits that the staff that would be supervising at that time and the children are aware. We know how to get them out as quickly as possible. However, when we go down into a lockdown situation, as Officer Murphy pointed out, we may not always know whether the problem is on the inside of the building or on the outside of the building. our first impulse would be to secure the rooms and keep everybody inside the building. Unless, of course, we had a shooter or someone in that area, then our response would be to exit the children. And everyone is aware of where the doors are, what the plan is, which is the reason for having these drills, is because we can respond. We don't have to second-guess ourselves. We know what the plan is. We go over it and over it. The first time we did a lockdown drill, we noticed that there were some things wrong. Those of us who go through the building to check and see how the system is working found some flaws in it. But this was good. As Dan Murphy stated, this is great because we want to find those things at the time that we're doing our drill and be able to make changes in it. He also stated that there's never going to be a time when we have 100% safety for everyone. If a shooter is in the building or some other sort of threat, we know we can't possibly protect every single situation and know that we have an answer. But we are much better prepared. Having this plan in place and practicing it frequently, we feel that we're prepared to respond as well as we can to protect as many as we can.
Okay, I have several members with questions. Next up, Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Erdahl, I just really want to thank you for bringing this school safety bill forward. I think it's a great bill. Had many conversations with some local public safety people in my district, and actually beat me to the punch, which is great. But it's a great bill. I just think it's wonderful. I just want to take a couple seconds here to tell a couple of quick stories. On Monday, my kids were out of school, so I thought I'd take them to go have lunch with my wife at where she works. She works at a hospital. Well, at the hospital, all of a sudden we're sitting down to eat, and the fire alarm starts going off, and you know, which is, to me, kind of a big deal. Well, nobody moves. Nobody moves. Everybody sits there. Not a single person moves, and everybody just keeps eating. It's at Woodwinds in Woodbury, and it has a lot of windows, and you know, so you could probably get out pretty quick if you needed to, but nobody moved. So I go to the next story, which is about a year ago. My son, at his school, there was a bank robber that was going through the neighborhood, or had left, and the police were in pursuit, and got near the school grounds, and they did a lockdown at his school. Well, you know, that's reality. So that's, and I thought it was great that they did that, and I think it's great that you're bringing this bill forward. There's a lot of good things that you're working with the public safety folks. I think what it says is part of the fire departments have done a great job of, you know, comfort level and keeping us safe, but this is obviously, it's sad. This is reality, and those numbers show it. It's amazing, those numbers that really make you flinch as a parent. When I went to your press conference, and then you kind of alluded to it too, about the different times of day, and I'm just going to ask you kind of a question, kind of a softball, any question, but I think it's fascinating to tell the members of why the different times of day, and you kind of alluded, you know, Representative Severson about the lunchtime scenario, but it's a little bit different than a fire drill. I mean, so you can talk about when these different events often happen, and why you would do five and different times of the day. But thank you for bringing this forward, and I think it's a great bill.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, Representative Lilly. It's easy to do drills in a very controlled circumstance. The drill that, I've taught for a while at New London Spicer, announced my retirement last week, by the way. The first time we did a drill was 2 years ago, and we did not use students at all, just the teachers. I thought, you know, as Ms. Depke has said, people need to know how to react. And in a crisis, it's very difficult for a teacher, even if that teacher knows how to react, to explain it to, you know, 20, 30 or more kids in an instant what to do. So that's why we need to have repetitive drills involving the students, and also doing them at different times of the day, because as I started out by saying, the second time we did it was at 9 o'clock in the morning. Everyone knew that we were going to have the drill. at 5 minutes to nine, I said, all right, nobody's going to the bathroom. You're not going to get a drink. You're all going to be in here at 5 to 9 because we got a drill at 9. I mean, we've been told to tell them that. And it's all right to do a drill or two that way. But realistically, that's not when these instances happen. Most of them have been, as I am told, before school or noon hour or times like that. And I fear right now chaos in most of our school districts. If an intruder were to perpetrate violence during a lunchroom time, I think that a lot of our kids simply wouldn't know where to go or what to do. They ought to go to safe areas. They need to practice this, or they simply will react as I think Officer Murphy said, very unpredictably, and it could lead to disastrous consequences. So they have to know what to do, they have to repeat it, and they have to do it at unpredictable times of the day.
Okay, I have four members with questions. First up, Representative Haas.
Representative Verdon, as you know, I'm a past county commissioner, and many of the schools were starting to voluntarily put in lockdown drills because it's obviously a part of their safety program. When we have established 9 fire drills in a year, how did that number 9 come about? Was that a standard? Was that just a number that was picked out of the air? How do we know that we're not moving into a dangerous situation by reducing that number? Are we reducing the number of fire drills and putting in lockdown drills because of disturbances to the classroom or because of costs to the schools? Well, why are we doing it that way?
Madam Chairman, Representative Haas, first of all, I think that the number 9 was picked as a number simply because there are 9 months in the school year, and the idea was to do one a month. But as a teacher, and you were a teacher as well.
Yes.
I think you understand that you know, fire drills, after a time, you become very quickly accustomed to how to do them. If you do several in the fall, a couple in the spring, or the other way around, you can do this. You don't need 9. You know how to do it after a few. And so that's why I think we can reduce it from 9 to 5. Also, the concern is not an expense to schools in terms of money, but an expense to schools in terms of time. There are all kinds of things that interfere with a student's, with a student and with a teacher's time to teach. And, you know, from, well, I won't get into all the things that interfere, but that's another topic. Representative Demmer and I will discuss that.
I want to remind members that this bill is next going to education policy. We've got 3 other members with questions and then 1 other amendment to look at before we adjourn in about 15 minutes here. But next up, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Erdahl. One concern I would like you to think about is whether or not we ought to add a school counselor to the list of people on the advisory task force. In my area, you know, in Minneapolis, in different parts, you have issues where kids are living in unsafe neighborhoods in which they see the school as a safe place where they don't have to worry quite so much about violence and those sorts of things. And I'm thinking that particularly special ed kids, early kids, sometimes have a hard time understanding, you know, sort of the borders and can sometimes obsess about things. And it seems to me that that's something, if we overly focus on just doing the drill and we don't think enough about how students may absorb that, may react to it, how the information is communicated, whether it's a real situation or not, I think is really important. And we had a situation in one of my schools recently in which a school brought a child brought a weapon to school in their backpack, and there was all kinds of misinformation and confusion coming out from different sources, and it got played out in the press and in the community. And one of the things that I would hope that the advisory task force would address, how to effectively do emergency communications how to establish responsibility for who is to provide that communication, who quickly is the spokesperson. I've gone through some public health emergency planning, and there's very clear models for how you do this. But when you have the police saying one thing and the school saying something else and the kids bringing home wild stories from school, you end up with a situation in which you create a lot of chaos and a lot of distrust instead of confidence in the situation. So I would hope that you would think about that as you proceed. And then I have a second issue, but would you like to respond to that first?
Representative Erdahl.
I'm kind of a one-issue response kind of guy. So. thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Wofford. First of all, regarding this task force, I am inclusive rather than exclusive. If there are, you know, different groups that you think should be included, I likely will have little problems with that. And so we can certainly look at including those. One of the main reasons why we are creating this task force is the need to look at how and who should be educated. And one of the main reasons, they just give you a specific example, is the concerns about younger children and their understanding of this. We did talk to a school psychologist, actually a child psychologist, and it's important that those who teach the younger children understand how to present this to them, and that's part of the education process, that those who teach in lower elementaries need to be aware of how to best present the possibilities of violence to children. I mean, children are, you know, they're used to lockdowns. I mean, from we're going to lock the house, to we lock the car doors, we lock this, we lock that. But how to present it to them in the best light is part of the charge, I think, that this task force should consider.
Follow up, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Riddle. The other thing I'd like you to think about is, and I love the language that you have in here of all hazards, because there's a variety of things, unfortunately, face as a community these days, but looking at whether or not that ought to also include minimizing exposure to communicable diseases. I see the Department of Health is one of the recommended participants in this, and, you know, there's a lot of planning being done right now on pandemic situations with pandemic influenza. The SARS had 10,000 people exposed and under, or potentially at risk and under quarantine in Toronto when that was traveling the globe by the airplane. We're now dealing with the potential issue of Asian flu. And, you know, there may be a situation in which schools really have to have thought through with their public health agencies some ways to deal with protecting the health of the students, not just from potential violence, but also in terms of exposure to communicable disease, who comes to work, who doesn't, what do you do with sick kids, that kind of planning I think would really help us as well. And so I'm picking up on the all hazards and hoping you'll think about exploring a little broader interpretation.
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman, Representative Luckley. We attempt to do that, but, you know, the schools have a crisis management plan that they should maybe look at this with. What we're trying to do here is to focus at the lockdowns of the violent perpetrator.
Okay. Let's go on to Representative Neil Peterson, and then I think we might come back to Representative Loeffler with an oral amendment.
Thank you,
Madam
Chair.
Peterson.
I have to go to an 11:30 meeting, and I just wanted to compliment Bloomington for being here and tell both of you, good job. Thursday, both of your supervisors, Superintendent Press and Chief Lutz, were here testifying. They both got shot down. I can sense you're doing well. They both lost the committees they testified for. So good job. Thank you. You make Bloomington proud. I appreciate your expertise.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thanks, Mayor. Next up, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Erdahl, I like this bill, too. I think it's a great idea. It really needs to be done. I think we all agree on that. Since this is the GovOps committee, I think we're supposed to focus more on the advisory task force piece of this. And I do have some my questions really relate to the funding, whether this is an unfunded mandate. But since the committee you're in relates to the advisory task force, I was just wondering if you might think about adding some language that would ask the task force to advise on whether special funding might be needed and whether it might even be categorical funding. Have you given any thought to that, where the funding stream might come from? Because even though I know you said that you didn't think it would be additional money, I mean, there are things being at least recommended to be thought over here that certainly would involve funding.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Representative Liebling. I'm certainly looking at, we could look at the possibility, if the committee needs funding, to ask for that. But I'm trying to do something that can get this thing through this year and trying to avoid funding. That's why I anticipated that this would be a voluntary committee and that we would try to staff it as much as we could ourselves with the idea that the Department of Education would be open to provide some assistance regarding mainly information.
Follow up, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Right, Representative Erdahl, I think maybe I didn't get my question across real clearly. It wasn't about funding so much for the advisory committee itself, but for the schools to actually do this, and whether the committee might actually talk about and decide about whether funding should be recommended to actually help schools do this so that it's not an unfunded mandate on schools.
Okay.
Madam
Chairman, there was a Liebling. We could examine what the cost of schools, that could be one of the charges of the task force. However, like Ms. Zepke, the things that she was talking about, those are actually including the crisis management plan, those types of things. The expenses that I'm talking about, I don't know. It's you shut and lock your door for the most part. These other reports, name tags, these types of things, most schools are already doing these, and they're part of their crisis management plan, which is separate from what this is.
Okay. Let's go to Representative Loeffler, who has an oral amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is in follow-up to my last comment. It would add the school counselors to the list of participants in the advisory task force.
Page and line number, please.
The page would be line 3, line 14.
Page
after
three.
Principals, insert school counselors, semicolon.
Okay. Representative Loeffler moves oral amendment. And that's on page 3, line 14, after principals, insert the word school counselors. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Any discussion? Officer Murphy.
I've taken approximately 40 schools from nothing to an up-and-running lockdown drill doing various amounts of drills a year. That's going in, working with the school staff, being there when they actually do the very first drill, and following up with them on every successive drill that they've done. The good plan today is better than the perfect plan tomorrow. These are very low-cost items. We're making paper posters to cover windows. There are some hardware issues. I had asked Pat Depke from Indian Mounds to keep track of all expenses that the school incurred on their way to going to a complete lockdown drill. That's under $300. So the schools, to summarize, now, it's very strange. I'm all of a sudden the lockdown guy. And people are very hungry, both in the private school sector, the public school sector. But not every city has a Dan Murphy or a police department that's that progressive to go out and get there. And without a mandate, what I'm afraid of is that we're going to have schools, be it outlying agencies, wherever, that will not do these drills. And they're very needed. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Erdahl, quickly.
Yes, Madam Chairman, I'll accept that amendment.
Okay, to the Representative Loeffler, oral amendment, page 3, line 14, insert school counselors after principals. Any discussion? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, amendment is adopted. Okay, that's it for member questions. There might be somebody from the audience, but let's look at the other amendments. This is coded A06-1148. Chair moves this amendment. And there's an update to it, an oral change to incorporate. That would be on page 1, line 2, where it says page 1 after line 21. With the delete all amendment, the 21 changes to 19. So that line reads page 1 after line 19 insert. I'd like to incorporate that with my amendment. Members, I have a related bill to Representative Erdahl's bill, and I was approached by school members at the Anoka-Hennepin District that I represent, as well as members of the Coon Rapids Police Department, and they're kind of moving in concert with what's going on with Representative Erdahl's bill. In addition, my bill had this small provision in it, which relates to secondary school teachers to make sure that anybody who's teaching a class in law enforcement actually be post-certified, so they have the police officer standards, training board background or standards covered. And this came up because there was an issue with one school district who had home economics teachers teaching law enforcement, and you know, especially with all the homeland security issues that we have nowadays, we thought it was important to put this in place. I did have a quick hearing on this provision last year, and there was no objection to it. So I'd like to put it with Representative Erdahl's bill to keep this issue moving as it relates to this issue. And yes, Representative Kahn, your issue earlier with Representative Beard and learning that if you have another bill and it relates to something going through committee, you may want to amend it. So, thank you. So anyway, to my amendment, the A061148, any discussion? Representative Seibert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just got a question. If I'm not totally understanding this. If there is like a self-defense class that they have to take for their license, would that person have to be post-certified?
Representative Seibert, this only relates to high school students.
Okay,
so,
Thank you. Sorry about that.
Yeah, and I know I worked with one of the legislators related to Subdivision 3 here, community education programs, so that was excluded from this requirement. Okay, Representative Erdahl, do you have a comment on this amendment? Representative Erdahl.
No, I don't.
Is it okay?
It's okay.
Thank you. Okay. I'd like to renew my motion on this amendment, A061148, as amended. In discussion, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and the 1148 amendment is adopted into this bill. Okay. I didn't have any other members with questions. Let's see if there's anybody from the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill as amended. Anybody from the audience? Seeing none. Members, any other questions before we vote on this? Representative Erdahl, you get the final word before we vote. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your attention and your support.
Thank you. With that, Chair renews the motion that House File 2492 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Education Policy. Any discussion? All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and that bill does go to Education Policy. Thank you, Representative Erdahl. Members, we're going to be adjourning here in just a minute to go over to session. Tomorrow we'll have a very short meeting from 10:15 to 11:15 because of the state of state. We do have three bills up tomorrow. We hope they're quick ones, but please try to be here by 10:15 so we can get those moving through. With that, meeting is adjourned.